You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
All the girls are complicated. Everyone is precious too, and you might get lucky if you do. Oh, you might get lucky if you do. Find the one that makes you laugh. Find the one that takes your breath, where you won't get everything that you want. Oh, but you'll need one to dote upon.
Hello, and welcome to Christian Feminist Podcast, episode number 195, The Legacy of Kathy Geiswyde. I'm Katie Grubbs, and with me today are Victoria Reynolds Farmer and Sarah Thomas. Hi!
Hey there.
Hello.
So we're going to quickly introduce ourselves for any listeners that are new to the program. Sarah, why don't you go first?
Sure. Hi, I'm Sarah Thomas. I have a PhD in English literature with a concentration in 18th century British studies from Florida State University. I am currently a high school English teacher living in the metropolitan Atlanta area. I moved back at the beginning of the year, so I'm getting used to some new digs and some new surroundings. So apologies in advance if my neighbor's dog decides to get really excited about a squirrel while we're recording tonight.
Thanks for the warning. I was going to apply a similar warning, but mine is for small boys playing outside the door of the room that I'm in. Victoria, why don't you go next?
Hi, everyone. I am Victoria Reynolds Farmer. I have a PhD in Renaissance drama and gender studies, also from Florida State. And I also live in the metro Atlanta area, very close to Sarah's new place, a fact about which I am very happy because we get to hang out more.
That's so cool. I am Katie Norman Grubbs. I did my PhD in English literature at the University of Georgia. I currently kind of have two different jobs. Three jobs. My main job is taking care of the four children I share with David Grubbs of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. And I also have two other gigs. One is that I am adjunct professor of English for Houston Christian University. I've taught for them since 2017, and I do that all online from where I live, right outside Birmingham, Alabama. And then my other much more recent gig is that since January, I've been a substitute teacher in our local school system because I wanted to be more involved in our local schools. And so I've been doing all kinds of interesting jobs in the last few months. I've been a librarian in a primary school. I've been a fourth grade teacher for a day. I've been a special ed resource teacher, a second grade teacher. I've gotten to do all kinds of interesting stuff, including subbing in my own child's class one day. So all that has been a lot of fun, but it'll be nice to have a break from that too in the summertime. We wanted to get started tonight by just going through why talk about Kathy at all. I chose this topic, so I'm just going to give it a little quick breakdown on the surface of it. It doesn't necessarily make sense because this is a comic strip that began decades ago and ended in 2010, so why talk about it now? And honestly, it was a little bit accidental. My oldest child, Arden, has gotten super into reading Peanuts and Calvin and Hobbes lately, and she spends a lot of time reading vintage Peanuts comics from like the 50s and 60s, which is very cute. But I had been doing some research into those strips, the strips that she most enjoyed, and had kind of stumbled on a really interesting article about Kathy, which is the SIME article that we're going to talk about in a little while. And that kind of led me down a Kathy rabbit hole. And so I found it really interesting. And I thought talking about this particular strip would be very relevant to our interest as a podcast. So that's why I chose this topic. So the first thing that I wanted to do before we get to our kind of our readings and background and all that stuff is I kind of just wanted to ask round robin, what's your past experience with kind of comics in general and or with Kathy in particular? When did you first encounter this comic strip and what did you think about it? Victoria, you want to go first?
Sure. I was not really a newspaper comic strip kid. I read comics when I was a kid. I got like the, I think back then they were like 50 cents or 99 cents from the rack in the grocery store. I was super into X-Men when I was a kid, as I think a lot of disabled kids are, because there's a lot of disability allegory there. I was also, because my mother got me started on them because she had loved them when she was a kid, really into Archie comics. I read a lot of Betty and Veronica when I was in like second, third, fourth grade. I am not sure I had ever read an actual Kathy strip until I started prepping for this episode. Like,
Wow, okay.
I had definitely made fun of Kathy strips like my entire life. I think I had just kind of absorbed the whole stereotype. It's just kind of in the air to the point that early in our relationship, whenever I did something stereotypical, whenever I like wanted chocolate or to watch a rom-com or whatever, Michael and I would look at each other and say "ack" like it was a thing that we did early in our relationship that we don't really do anymore. But so like that happened, but I'm not sure I'd ever read an actual Kathy strip until about, I don't know, 3 or 4 months ago. But now I've read quite a few.
I love that. You're very on brand for this episode. Sarah, how about you?
I, like Victoria, didn't seek out Kathy Comics as a younger person. My dad did, he never subscribed to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, but he picked up the Sunday paper. He would make a ritual sort of out of walking across the street. There's a shopping center across the street from the neighborhood where my parents live. And he would walk across the street to the Kroger on the weekends and pay for the weekend paper and would read the hard copy AJC. Section by section, he would spread it all out on the kitchen table and take most of a Saturday or a Sunday morning to read it. And so when comics would show up in the newspaper and they were lying around and were readily available to me, I would pick them up and peruse them. And so I would browse the comics, including Kathy. And I remember the greeting cards. I know these, the Syme article, I think that we're going to talk about in a little bit, mentions the paraphernalia that accompanied Kathy once the comic strip took off. And I definitely remember the greeting cards. I remember some of that paraphernalia. I remember some of it showing up in my house. I suspect that my mom may have picked it up. So kind of like Victoria mentioned, it was part of the cultural milieu sort of percolating in the background when I was a younger person, but I didn't necessarily seek it out for myself again until we started prepping for the episode here.
Thanks. We also did not have a subscription to the newspaper that I remember, but it would we would sometimes my parents would sometimes buy an issue, or I would read it at my grandparents. And I was also a huge fan of Archie Comics when I was a kid. I would pick out Archie Comics in the checkout at the grocery store, and I always really enjoyed those. And if we ever had if I ever had access to a newspaper, I always read the comics. And because as a child, I'm less this way as an adult, but I'm still kind of this way. I was definitely a completist. So when we would get this Sunday comics or whatever, I would read every single comic strip on the page. I wouldn't just look at the ones that seemed more targeted towards kids or the ones even that I thought looked most interesting. I would read all of them. So I'd be like a 10-year-old reading Kathy, Dilbert, like I mean, you know, these things that were about like adult experiences that I'd never had. In the case of Kathy, I was reading about an experience that didn't have much resonance for me because my own mom sometimes worked outside the home, but never full time. My main experience of my mom was that she was at home with us. And so, you know, I never heard her talk about like the office, you know, or anything like that. And so it was pretty alien. And so I think my kind of attitude as a kid, probably reading that stuff, was like, oh, adults, that's adult stuff. You know, I don't really remember absorbing it. I do think I absorbed some of the attitudes, particularly about body image and things like that, these articles talk about in Kathy. I do think I got some of those ideas, but not so much from reading Kathy as from the ways that adult women in my life would talk about stuff like that around me. And so it was kind of, you know, it was kind of always around. And I remember years and years later, David and I absolutely loving Andy Samberg being Kathy on SNL. We thought that was hilarious. And would sometimes, you know, would say ack or things like that after that, because it reminded us of Kathy. And the Grubs, and there were all, after David and I got together, there were always tons of comics at the Grubs house, because David's family was the kind of family when he was a kid that didn't have a TV, and the kids would fight over the Sunday comics every week, right? Because this was one of their main forms of entertainment. And when we first got married, maybe still today, you'll find random boxes of cutout comic strips around their house. And they had some collections. Like, I remember finding and reading as a young married person, because there was nothing else to read. I didn't bring anything else to read with me. And I read like a whole collection. I read like a Baby Blues book of all these Baby Blues strips. Why? I don't know. There was nothing else to read. It was that and National Geographic. I'd always be reading at David's parents' house, comics and National Geographic. So I did frequently read Kathy, but as a child, which is kind of odd then to reencounter it now as an adult. But I just kind of wanted to, you know, to give a sense to listeners of where we are. And just a quick preface too, none of us are comics scholars. Those are a thing and they're great. But none of us are those. So if we don't seem, you know, like we are comparing, you know, too many other things to Kathy or talking too much. Like, I know when I was reading Khan's article, she's tossing out names of all these different, you know, comics and probably in graphic novel writers and titles that I had never even heard of. But that's because she's writing in Comics Journal, right? And so it's a specific milieu. Well, let's shift in to, I kind of combined knowing and reading this episode, just because we're going to give a little bit of brief background, but then really jump into the readings pretty fast. I'm going to start just by giving a little background on Kathy Geiswite, the author, and her work in the history of the comic strip. So Kathy Geiswite was born in 1950. She's still alive today. She had started out working in advertising as a kind of ambitious, recently graduated co-ed, and she ascended rapidly and ended up vice president of her advertising firm at age 26. And the story that I read doing research this week is that she had started drawing these little comics as a way of kind of dealing with her emotions of still not really feeling completely satisfied with herself or with her life, despite having achieved really pretty phenomenal career success for her age. And so she started drawing these comics. And not unlike Kathy, the character in the comic strip, was pushed by her own mother into submitting some of these strips to a comics syndicate, and then was kind of shocked when it got published, and when she got a deal to have a syndicated comic. And so from age 26 until 2010, so from 1976 to 2010, she was drawing the Kathy comic strip. It ran for 34 years in the newspapers, and also merchandise, like Sarah mentioned, book collections, all of these things. Since Kathy ended, she's written two different memoir books. On the personal side, she's has one daughter, and one grown daughter. And yeah, and so on the comic strip side, you know, it was such a long-running strip that it, like Victoria and you guys were saying, it was just always in the air because it ran for 34 years. So, you know, Kathy started in 1976. So when I was getting old enough to read the comics, you know, it would have been around, I was born in 83. So, you know, it would have still been in its first 15 years when I was reading it as a child. By the time it ended, I had stopped reading it mainly just because once I left for college, I wasn't living in a household that got a paper ever. Cause we didn't really, you know, like I didn't have a subscription to a newspaper at college. And so, and I kind of moved on to more, if I was reading kind of ephemeral, you know, media, like things you might toss out or not save. I was reading magazines usually in college, not not newspapers. But the comic strip Kathy encompassed within its run, Kathy, the characters, like work struggles, and progress in her career, her love life. Eventually, late in the run, she finally gets married to Irving, who is her husband. And then, and other characters are introduced, her mom, her dad, Andrea, her more overtly political feminist friend. There's a lot of different people who kind of come in and out. And then the final strip that ran in 2010, in that strip, you find out that Kathy's pregnant and she shares with her parents that she's going to have a baby. And the tiny baby in the womb says, "Ack," which I never knew that until I was researching for this episode. I never knew how Kathy ended. I found out we were planning this. So that's just kind of a very basic rundown for any listeners who somehow have not encountered Kathy before. We're going to kind of give a little brief summary of these two articles before we dive into their content. And Victoria is going to start that out for us.
So the first article we're going to discuss is The Feminist Paradox of Kathy Geiswhite by Rachel Syme. It was published in The Cut in 2019. And in the piece, Syme interviews Geiswhite in advance of the publication of 50 Things That Aren't My Fault, Essays from the Grown-Up Years, one of the two memoirs that Katie mentioned. This book is a collection of observations about getting older. It's her first book of essays and her first major project since Kathy the Strip ends. They talk about the legacy of the strip, its kind of cultural resonance with a certain generation of women. Geiswhite notes that the strip at its heart is the four basic guilt groups, food, love, mom, and career, and that the strip is very much about balancing pressures in Kathy's life, Kathy the character's life, coming from different directions. The piece says, when one or two areas of Kathy's life are going well, the others are invariably falling apart. I found that probably too relatable. Syme centers the piece around a paradox, the fact that younger generations of feminists often see Kathy the Strip as limited and restrictive, even as anti-feminist, while the author Kathy Geiswhite is a feminist pioneer in a primarily male space, writing about what she knew and what lots of women around her knew. Katie also mentioned this, even as much of the strip is about a guilt-driven relationship with one's mother, it was Geiswhite's actual mother who encouraged her to publish it in the first place. And the latter half of Syme's piece is about Geiswhite's post-Kathy life, personal and professional, and ends with a few thought-provoking statements that I wanted to share. Syme praises the, quote, aggressive vulnerability of the essay collection, and Geiswhite includes the self-assessment, my voice is never going to change the world. My voice will help women get through the next 5 minutes, and I'm fine with that. I found that kind of beautiful in its normality. And I want to end my summary with this paragraph, which I think cuts to the heart of the cultural complexity of such a simple-seeming text. It would be easy to dismiss Geiswhite from across the generational chasm as simply a byproduct of her time, but Kathy's struggles aren't quite as far from our own as we'd often like to think. Women may have more nuanced language for how they talk about the distance between what they choose to project and how they feel on the inside, but 2 minutes on Instagram is enough to prove that generating authentic confidence is still a confounding process.
Thanks. That's an awesome summary. And I loved that next 5 minutes quote too. I wrote it down in the paper. The way that she kind of owns the cultural space that she staked out and kind of acknowledges that her whole project is helping in the moment and not trying to be, you know, not trying to create something that makes her seem like a great thinker. You know, I like the normality, like you said. It's very personal too. Okay, thank you so much. And then Sarah's going to quickly walk us through just a little intro to the other article that we read for this episode.
Okay, so the second piece that we're going to discuss today was written by Juliet Kahn for the Comics Journal in April. It was published in April of 2018, and I believe it's actually referred to in the cut piece that Victoria just summarized. And the title of the piece is called On Hating Kathy. And the piece begins by considering and commenting on the seemingly overwhelmingly negative reaction to the end of Kathy that Katie summarized for us. That the vitriol that followed the conclusion of Kathy seemed to be summed up in a couple of the comments that we've already mentioned, that it is a betrayal of its audience, that it is a comic that by the time it ended was past its prime, that it's outdated, certainly stereotypical and annoying, according to one of the commentaries that was released at its conclusion. And it explains, the piece then goes on to explain or to propose, on Kahn's part, that what people seem to dislike about Kathy is that she is lame, that she is, and I'm going to quote here, too pitiful for feminism, too female for the mainstream. So she is plainly lame. And that in part, it is that lameness, the mundanity, right, the mundane aspect of her life that people feel like they have to reject because, in the end, what she stands for is all of the things we are either trying to overcome or to avoid becoming ourselves. So that therefore she must be rejected. And the piece concludes, Kahn concludes her piece by making a claim for Kathy, for trying to reclaim her legacy, to say that contrary to assessments that she is, that she is not a role model, that she's something that is born out of fear, that she is what we are terrified of becoming, that instead she is an artifact of woman's play, that she is, while she might not be a role model, she is a character to empathize with. And so the proposal is to argue that, and I'm going to quote from part of the later, a later paragraph in the piece here, Kathy is important. And beyond all of that, Kathy is good. Kathy is incisive and funny and clever. Kathy takes the slop of my life, the shame and the pain and the work of it, and manages to find it funny without diminishing it. All those women who taped up Kathy comics to their refrigerators and cubicle walls, their appreciation is just as meaningful, multidimensional, and significant as your love for Calvin and Hobbes, Pogo, and Life in Hell. Kathy managed to make women laugh about the circumstances of their lives without blaming them for those circumstances. Kathy wants you to know that you're not alone in feeling the way that you do. And at the end of that, I was paraphrasing.
Thank you so much. And let's, for on that note, let's just jump into some questions. Victoria, you had mentioned in the Syme article, and actually Syme notes that Guyswade herself described Kathy as extremely of its time. You'd mentioned it appeared at a particular point in history. Do you guys agree with that characterization that it's very specifically of its time? And if you do, why or how? How is that true of Kathy in a way that might not be of other comic strips?
I mean, yes and no, I think. When you said it ran from 1976 to 2010, like, think about the changing face of feminism in those years, and like the preoccupations of the women's movement and how they evolve. So I do think that a lot of early Kathy can seem irrelevant to maybe women our age or even feminists younger than us, but if it is, it's because it was super relevant in its time, and it made women feel seen when a lot of kind of regular culture wasn't doing that. What I really got out of both of these pieces is like how much I was being presentist in my disdain for Kathy without even really knowing what it was. Like the fact that so many second waivers saw themselves and felt validated by it, like, that makes it worth a perusal in my book.
Yeah, Victoria, I really appreciate all of your comments there. And as you were speaking to those, I was thinking about how a line, and I'm sorry, I can't remember if it was from Syme or from Kahn, but the reference that I think it might be in the Syme piece, where Geiswite herself says that refers to having a foot in both worlds, that that she left high school and left high school understanding Betty Crocker, and while she was in college encountered Betty Friedan, right? Friedan. So she had one foot in both worlds. And there, I think, is an aspect of continuing to try to understand womanhood and femininity that still speaks, that I think is still relevant, right? Even almost 15 years beyond the conclusion of the comic, where there are discussions going on between, women who choose careers outside the home, or trad wives, or, you know, any of these other potentially contested spaces where we're talking about, or where we're trying to talk about or trying to discern what it means to be adult women and to live and work and move through the world as women, that I think transcends some of its, some of the particulars of its original publication dates and some of its earlier publication runs. And then the second thought that I had as I was reading both of these pieces was about, was whether or not what these pieces reveal is kind of a much bigger question about the purpose of different kinds of texts, in this case, comic strips. Are we reading them because we want them to be descriptive, or are we reading them expecting them to be prescriptive or aspirational? Are we reading them because we want to look at or we want to consume pieces of popular culture that are showing us how we can be, or that reveal, on the other hand, to us who we already are and look for the humanity in that? And it seems like Kathy does the latter, that hers is not prescriptive or aspirational, but rather descriptive, and that maybe that potential tension or disconnect between expectation and the encounter with the text itself is part of what some readers found unsettling towards the end of its run.
That's a really insightful point, I think. And I think a lot of that could also be at the root of lots of particularly feminine-coded pieces of culture that get derision. I think that a lot of this Kathy hate is a kind of not-like-other-girls-ism in a certain way. Thank you for making that point. I think it's really insightful.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I really liked the prescriptive-descriptive distinction too, because so often I think comic strips are descriptive, and the goal often is for us to be able to recognize ourselves in them. One of the best practitioners of that style to me is Strange Planet. I can't remember his name. The guy who draws the comics about little aliens doing everyday normal things. It's like a TV series now, but the words are just different, right? And it's treating normal human activities in a way that's different, but we recognize ourselves in it and we go, oh, that is how it is, you know?
Is that the blue and purple one? And they there's like a little alien kid and yeah, I love those.
Yes, he was just
Okay, I know what you're talking about, yeah.
Give me a second and I'll tell you his name. He got a series on Apple TV Plus. And it's
amazing.
Like a whole thing.
I didn't know that.
Yes. I didn't watch it because we don't have Apple TV, but I love those. It's the gentle comedy of going, oh, it is like that. Right. And I think that, you know, that quote that you read at the end about Kathy making you feel like you're not alone. Right. Because in the strip, too, she's showcasing all the awkwardnesses of being a grown woman. And she's just laying it all out. It's that same aggressive vulnerability, and it can be uncomfortable, and cringy, but life is though. and I think it is both of its time and for more than just its time. I do think that some of that very specific, Guy's White herself talked in the Syme article in the interview, she mentioned her mom gifting her subscriptions to Brides Magazine and Ms. Magazine, like at the same time when she finished college. I kind of
loved that moment.
Oh,
I know.
I felt that moment with my whole chest. Like I understood everything about that. Like, oof.
Yeah. And I think she probably, women of her specific age probably got it even worse, but I think we got it too. But the idea that, she was one of those first generations of women who were, their mom, it sounds like their moms had embraced parts or all of second wave, like her own mom, Kathy Geiswitz's own mom had a master's degree, but didn't actually, wasn't in the workforce. But, and one of the things that she said in the article that I thought was interesting too, is that, Geiswitz said that she thought that, she kind of thought that she wanted to just be single doing her thing. You know, that she thought that she didn't want, kind of marriage and a family and things like that, in part because, that's what they said we should do. Like the specific quote was something like, I wanted to be on my own because they said we should. And so then, so she had this really early career success and she was crushing it. And then she was feeling this sadness because she realized that she actually did also want these other things that she felt like she probably shouldn't want as badly as she did. And it was that tension that kind of drove her to create this. Right. And so then she put it all, she's putting it all into this little comic strip about expressing those things that are kind of pulling her in different directions. And I think that was especially strong at that moment when Kathy first got started. But it remains relevant today because, like you said, Victoria, some of that stuff resonates with us, too, now. And absolutely the being dissatisfied with your body. And the difficulty, all the Kathy strips, I remember as a kid, all the Kathy strips about the near impossibility of finding a good bathing suit in a department store. Even as a kid, I was like, that's so real. Like, you know what I mean? Like that kind of stuff doesn't change. That's just as true in 2024 as it was in 1976. And so I think that's why it is still relevant today. But I also think sometimes that one reason that very young feminists today, don't always understand it or were, why people were hating on it at the end of Kathy is because I think sometimes, particularly young people, are wanting their media to be prescriptive or aspirational in that way. And so can feel frustrated, right? That Kathy, which was groundbreaking for featuring a single woman as its main character, eventually 34 years later ends in Kathy married and finding out she's pregnant. People were upset about that. On the other hand, you know, if you think about it on the flip side, from the point of view of her creator, if she's honoring Kathy the character, those are things that Kathy said that Kathy the character wanted. And that's the thing I was thinking about today. I was talking to David about all this, and I was, you know, telling him about how people were mad, or that, you know, when she in like 2005, like over, you know, decades into this comic strip, Kathy finally got married, and there were people who were mad because they wanted Kathy to be single in perpetuity, right? Because they felt seen and they appreciated that there was a comic strip about a single woman. And I absolutely get that. On the other hand, though, if you think about it in terms of a character arc or character continuity, because that's something that Kathy did want, I appreciate as a reader that that's something that happened for her in the end. Now it took, you know, 30 years, I don't know. But comic time is slow, right? And so all of it is interesting. I wanted to, let me see, what was my next question? I don't want to get ahead of myself. Sarah, you read out the making women laugh about the circumstances of their lives without blaming them for those circumstances. Do you guys think that's true of Kathy and like, or in that that's, because I thought that was interesting because so often in Kathy, I feel like Kathy is blaming herself for what's going wrong in her life. But do you think the strip as a whole is helping women to laugh at themselves without blaming themselves? Do you think that's true?
I think a lot of kind of what I now like about Kathy having read more of it is that she kind of vocalizes my worst impulses about myself and gives them a place to go and makes me realize that, like, A, I'm not the only woman that feels that way, and B, like, it's not that serious. So I guess that means yes, I agree with that statement. I think just because she blames herself doesn't necessarily mean that the comic blames women for their circumstances. I think the comic, in having Kathy blame herself, understands the way that we as women often are our own worst critics and kind of says to us, like, it's okay, I understand, but also you don't have to stay in this place. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and because Kathy's our viewpoint character, you know, because so often in that strip, her own mom, even though always well-intentioned, would make Kathy feel terrible. And because Kathy's your viewpoint character as the reader, you're, at least I was always on Kathy's side, right? And so even if you see somebody else kind of throwing shade at her or, you know, trying to shame her for choices or whatever, because we've been with Kathy on this ride all along and we're more inclined to sympathize with her, we're not going to pile on Kathy. We're going to get frustrated with the person who's piling on Kathy. You know what I mean? And I like what you said about giving voice to your most critical thoughts or, kind of giving that commiseration point. And I like too that, so often I think that, women are kind of given, and not always from men, sometimes from other women, but often there's, you know, times if we express frustrations or whatever, there's, you know, people want to tell us what we should be doing differently to make things better or whatever. And that can be frustrating. But one of the things that's nice about Kathy is that it gives you that ability to just sit with it for a minute and it become and you begin to see, like you said, Victoria, that sometimes it helps you see it's not really that big of a deal. Or if it is still a really big deal, it helps you to kind of sit with the bad feelings for a minute and, you know, and be able to feel the feelings and not immediately go, well, how do I need to shape up? What do I need to do different? Like, you know, or whatever. It just kind of honors and leaves a little space for those negative feelings in a way that hadn't happened before. And I think that's the way one really connected with it when it was new. Hey Victoria, I wanted to jump down a little bit because I think we're kind of talking about this a little bit already. Kathy has lots of kind of to say about intergenerational pressure. I mentioned her mom earlier. But then also sometimes in the later strips, you'll see Kathy interact with younger women and have reactions to younger women. And there's some funny ones in that vein too. But there's all this intergenerational pressure and expectations among women that you see in the strip, and it explores how those pressures can affect choices, or how we feel about ourselves. And how do, since we're trying to think as Christian feminists, how do we see that kind of stuff play out, that intergenerational pressure play out specifically in the Christian realm where we're all living?
I mean, I really feel like I can mostly just speak from my experience here. It's funny because now in the community that we are primarily operating in, and in our immediate circle of friends, I am one of the oldest women in our group. A lot of the women that we hang out with are in their mid to late 20s primarily. So I, like, lots of people ask me for, like, marriage advice a lot, and that's been a weird place to land in for me. I don't really see myself as accomplished enough or experienced enough in that arena, but I've started kind of trying to look at myself differently because there are people who do see me that way. So I've had to kind of give myself credit for, you know, we have been married 15 years and, like, that is experience, and I guess I do have something to offer, but I still, I think, immediately come from, like, why would anybody listen to me? I'm just making it up as I go along. So I think that those kinds of questions happen for a lot of women, but also for Christian women, because there's that pressure of, like, having to fit a certain Christian woman mold too, that, like, you know, you should get married young and you should have lots of kids and you should XYZ. But there's obviously lots of ways to be any kind of person, but especially lots of ways to be a Christian woman that are valid. So I think I got a lot out of the prepping for this episode experience, because it made me think about that kind of checks and balance thing in my life. The phrase that I read really early in the intro about, like, you know, if work is good, then maybe your marriage is not good. And if that's good, then maybe this other thing is suffering. And, like, those are, all of that stuff is just life, right? I think that, I don't know. It's all complexity. And I think as Christian women, we feel that too, maybe just with some other layers added on.
I think you see it too. You mentioned that, like, Brides Magazine, Ms. Magazine dichotomy feeling really, really true to life for you, even though that, you know, we were kind of young college grads in the 2000s. And I felt that way too. And I think in some ways that weird bifurcation has hung on a lot longer in the church than in the secular world. In part because things like marriage and having a family tend to be highly valued in, you know, in faith-based spaces, not even just Christian, in other religions too. And so I think there's remained more of an emphasis in kind of Christian circles on things like getting married and having babies or things like this than you might find in the secular world at large. But at the same time, you know, our parents want us to succeed. And it was really important to my parents that I go to college. And so I got a college degree and I had an idea of what I wanted to do for a career, but they also really wanted for me to be able to get married and have a family, right? So that kind of, you know, the push-pull of two different, not two different lives, because those things can work together. But I think that's another reason that, I think that's another place you see that kind of intergenerational pressure in some ways in the church, maybe more than in the secular world, is because there's more emphasis placed I think in the Christian world on having those, I'm going to call them non-work adult experiences. I'll put it that way. Things to do with, like, getting married, having kids and stuff like that. And I think that, honestly, I think that could be another reason why much younger people are frustrated by Kathy, because I think in the right now, especially in the secular world, it's a much, much, much bigger focus on you do your thing. Usually that means work and hobbies. There's not a big emphasis on things like marriage and family and things like that. I mean, if people want to have them, that's fine. I'm not going to say people are hating on that, but the idea that that Kathy would still have something she wanted to have in her life that she didn't have yet, that would be the culmination of this comic strip, and that would be having a child, I think was really frustrating to a lot of younger readers of comics, because that is weird to them, because they're like, well, she has a career, and she wanted a life partner, and now she's got a life partner, and why does it have to end this way with her, having a baby? And so I think that, but I feel like to somebody on the Christian side, that might not have seemed as weird, because that's something that I think in the Christian world, at least, is still a little bit more valued. It's just kind of interesting how those things play in together. Sarah, did you have any thoughts on any of this particular stuff?
Yeah, as Victoria was talking, and then Katie, as you were talking, one of the things that came to mind for me, as a woman operating in Christian circles, as a woman operating in Catholic Christian circles, more specifically, was the discussion that were the discussions that I grew up having that I've been having in recent years. With women in my faith community about the concept of vocation. So, when we talk in Catholic circles about vocation, there are a couple of different senses in which we're talking about it. There's the sense in which people may talk about the vocation or a calling to the priesthood, to ministry, right? To the priesthood or for women to religious life as a nun or in another consecrated community. But then we also talk about the vocation to marriage. So the calling to live in a married state. There are also discussions about being called to the single life. So someone who might not necessarily be considering or who might not feel that their calling from God is to join, is to join the priesthood or to join a convent, but is to work as a lay person who is single, in various communities. And so one of the things that I was thinking about when it came to vocations was actually something that the woman who runs who facilitates the Bible study I've been going to on Monday nights for the last 3 years in discussion about vocations. She made the comment that sometimes our vocations are for a season. And so in her case, she lost her husband to cancer many, many, or maybe not many, many years ago, but several years ago. And so so she had envisioned for, that her calling to be married until death they parted, she thought that was a lot longer off, a lot farther off than it ended up being. So as someone who had been married, but whose vocation had been ended by death, one of the things that she talked about was trying to figure out what her vocation was in the next season of her life. And so thinking about that idea of some vocations being lifetime, some vocations being given to us for a season, I think considering Kathy's move from navigating single life to navigating married life can be understood in that same sort of seasonal sense. So to push back against some readers who might be critics of how Kathy ended, that she did in the last 10 years or so of the strip, end up getting married and then did end up having a child, something that she wanted for a long time before it actually happened. I think considering the fact that sometimes vocations can shift that how we move in the world as Christians and as women can change over time, and that those changes can in fact be good and can be willed for our good by God, can be perhaps a more helpful, a more charitable way to try to frame some of these shifts that do happen over the course of the comic strip's run.
I really, really like that approach. And I think it's true to life too, you know, thinking about the descriptive and prescriptive again, if Kathy's a descriptive comic for many, many, many people, that's the course that their adult life takes, you know, of getting a job, beginning a career, and then maybe getting married somewhere down the line, and then maybe having a kid somewhere down the line. And that switch into different types of vocations or adding of additional vocations is something that's happening all the time. I especially like the example you gave of somebody who is not kind of going through milestones and growing, but who's had a life change to necessitate a sudden change of vocation. I thought that was a great example. We need to do our passing on because we've been talking for a while, but I just wanted to, before we do that, was there any final thoughts you guys had about Kathy that you wanted to throw out here at the end?
Do you think that there is anything that has filled that space since Kathy ended? Or is it sort, or do we could maybe do a round robin? You know, do this one pretty quickly because I know we do need to get to our passing on. But do you think that this one is, if not flashy or glamorous, distinct in its approach, or has anybody, do y'all think, tried to take up the mantle?
I keep thinking about, I mentioned a kind of not like other girls-ism earlier, and I think post-fourth wave, or whatever wave we're on now, who even knows, I have seen a shift in recent feminism of this willingness to say, yes, I am like other girls, yes, I do like quote unquote basic things. You know, iced coffee with flavoring is good. Taylor Swift is a great music artist. Getting your nails done is fun. Whatever, you know, whatever that thing is that you would make fun of for being basic, there's a new movement to kind of embrace and celebrate those things. So that's not really a cultural artifact. Like Kathy, but I do think it is a notable post-Kathy shift in the way we talk about ourselves as women.
I think I like that. I think that's true. I think you see hints of Kathy in lots of places. I don't know that there's maybe one cultural artifact that's doing the kind of same thing. I think you see pieces of it. And this actually, to me, which this is not very recent, but I had thought about this earlier today, and I'm glad you asked this question because I forgot I wanted to say it. I think you can see the influence of Kathy actually in particular on the early, especially in the early seasons of Friends. I'm thinking specific, and that makes sense because that was like, you know, that was the early 90s. So Kathy had only been around for like less than 20 years at that point. But I'm thinking specifically of there's an episode in one of those the first or second season where they have a whole discussion about how they save they usually are just eating like low fat, low cal ice cream, but they save the really good ice cream for like the really terminal cases, like when somebody's had like a really bad breakup. And that feels like straight out of Kathy. Like, there was also a different time when they're all having like a really emotional night because they're not getting where they want to go in life, the three girls, and they're just laying around in their pajamas and complaining. And then they get upset because the pizza comes and it's the wrong pizza. They ordered a fat-free crust with extra cheese. And I don't know why that line stuck in my head for my whole life, but it did. Like, that sounds like something Kathy would do, right? She'd be like, well, I want extra cheese. So I'm going to get low-cal crust to like balance it out. I think you can feel Kathy sometimes in the early seasons of Friends. And I think you can see it a little bit in this feels like a weird example, but it's the one that sprang to mind today. I don't know if you guys have watched New Girl, but I think that Jess on New Girl has Kathy's aggressive awkwardness.
Yep.
And do you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. Now with her, it's pushing towards adorkable though. But there are times on that show when she's so just nakedly vulnerable and it gets really cringy, but in a way that's incredibly awkward. And it feels very Kathy to me. And even though that show can be very bro-y, because the whole point is that she lives with a bunch of guys, there are also episodes of that show where you can kind of see them doing a little bit of the, we're going to kind of talk about some female experiences. Like there's an episode of that show called Walk of Shame, where they've been out all night and they're trying to get back home and they look rough. And there's like mascara smeared everywhere, you know. So I just from New Girl is a little bit Kathy to me. Thank you for asking that question, Sarah, because that was one I had on my list and then I completely forgot about it. Let's end by passing on. We're going to recommend some things to you listeners. Some of them are comics related, some are not. Sarah, do you want to get started first? What are you recommending tonight?
I am going to make two recommendations. One of them is an extension of the discussion we had a few minutes ago about the concept of vocation and women and vocation. And so that's going to be John Paul II's Letter to Women, if I've made the recommendation before. I'm not going to apologize for the redundancy because everybody should read it because it's awesome. So John Paul II's Letter to Women. And then the second recommendation I'm going to make is a nod to Guys White herself and her creative process. That's going to be a book I started working my way through just last week. It's Julia Cameron's The Artist's Way.
The Artist's Way is great. I love it.
Thanks so much.
I'm really enjoying it so far.
I'm going to have to check it out. Victoria, how about you? What are you recommending?
So I was really struck in our readings by the phrase aggressive vulnerability. Because anybody who knows me, I will probably see me in that phrase for better or for worse. I'm a feeler, I'm a crier, I'm an oversharer. All of that stuff, is like really, resonated with me. And when I thought of that phrase, I thought about, the recent cultural conversation around the Tortured Poets Department, the new Taylor Swift album. I'm sure I've said many times on this show, and I know I've said many times in real life, I am a huge Swiftie. I listened to this album right after it came out. It is also aggressively vulnerable and has been criticized for being that way. I think this is more true of the second half of the album, the anthology tracks, which I like better than the album proper. Specifically, I want to call out for its aggressive vulnerability the song So High School, which is one of the two love songs about her current boyfriend, Travis Kelce, on the album, and it contains the truly cringe-inducing, but also really fantastic line. You know how to ball, and I know Aristotle. When she's talking about the difference between them, and like,
stop. I love it.
That's the lamest thing ever, right? Also, I love it, and I've been listening to it on repeat. So yes, Tortured Poets Department, specifically So High School, and yay, aggressive vulnerability.
I love that. I'm recommending two things. The first one is one that we mentioned earlier, but I couldn't remember the name, the person's name. So the first thing I'm recommending is Nathan W. Pyle's Strange Planet comic series. I looked him up. He's been publishing comics. I think he didn't start, it's only been around for a couple of years. I think he started writing, publishing that particular show. He writes all kinds of comics. This is not the only thing he does, but those started, I think, in 2021. And this year he had, there was an animated series, I think on Apple TV Plus. And it's little alien people doing normal human things, but saying it in a different way because they're aliens, and it's delightful. So you should check that out. And then the other thing I'm going to recommend, this is not a comic, but it is in the vein of, we talked about how Kathy is elevating the experiences of women by focusing on them exclusively. And we also talked about the idea of taking Kathy seriously as a way of honoring the experiences of women. And so I want to recommend a different series that takes kind of cultural artifacts that have been not really given much credit because women usually enjoy them, and that is the romantic comedy. And I'm recommending a series at the AV Club called When Romance Met Comedy by writer Caroline Seid. And I think I read all of these. The series ended in 2022. She was publishing one or two of them a month for several years, just looking at different romantic comedies and taking them seriously, taking it seriously as a genre. That was her stated project when she started the series, was we shouldn't write off an entire genre of films because mostly women watch them. And so she doesn't, every article's not a paean. She's not saying they're all great. But she's very thoughtfully considering the merits and demerits of a lot of different types. And listeners, it's not just kind of the most mainstream white people romantic comedies. She's got some great articles about Asian romantic comedies, black casted romantic comedies. She's got ones, she's got gay and lesbian romance movies in there. So she kind of, and also there's age diversity too. She talks about ones that are written towards older audiences, like some of the more recent Diane Keaton movies and stuff like that. So there's something for everybody if you like romantic comedies. And if you have dissed romantic comedies before, maybe give a couple of those articles a read. It might open your mind. So that's my other recommendation, is Caroline Seid's When Romance Met Comedy series. Well, listeners, thank you so much for coming with us to talk about Kathy. I'm shocked that I got all the way through this and we haven't said one ack the whole time. So I'll say it now. Ack. Thank you for listening to the Christian Feminist Podcast. We love to hear from you. If you have topic ideas or reading recommendations for us, or if you just want to get in touch, you can do that at christianfeministpodcast@gmail.com. You can also talk to us on our Facebook page. Or at the network's Twitter handle, at CH Radio Network. And you can find the show notes from this and our other episodes at christianhumanist.org. We are a member of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. For Sarah Thomas and Victoria Reynolds Farmer, I'm Katie Grubbs. Tune in 1 month from now for a discussion of the film Journey to Bethlehem. Until then, in essentials, unity, and non-essentials, liberty, and in all things, love.